one by one. It was a particularly pleasing arrangement because it kept Hart on his feet and prevented him from eating. Instead, he was forced to stand by the booth, able to smell the food while Clisson conducted his interrogations. Clisson took no small satisfaction in hearing his stomach gurgle. He hadn't forgotten how Hart had executed the prisoner at Shoal Point without Clisson's permission, claiming the credit for himself. It didn't take long to build up a picture of events in the courtyard. Of the 8 fugitives that had escaped his dreadnoughts, 7 had survived. The Skarl was still with them, and so was the traitor's boy and his hay-brained friend. The druidess, too, though no one recognised her as such. And now they were travelling with a sard and a Harish noble. Likely he was the swordsman who'd so precisely impaled those men in the barn. But what was their connection to the others? The fugitives could have kept their heads down and passed unnoticed. Instead, they'd got into a fight in front of dozens of witnesses, ensuring they'd all be remembered. They might as well have blown a horn to announce their presence. Clisson sensed weakness. First, his quarry had fallen for the trap at Sulla's Bluff. Only the incompetence of the camp's guards and an unfortunately timed breakout saved his life. Now he'd slipped up again. He was like a wounded animal, harried and exhausted. It was only a matter of time. Finally, his meal long finished and washed down with a glass of strong Croden Red, he called for the innkeeper. His name was Rappapet. He had a long, sensuous face and delicate hands, a fluting voice and a cat's grace. Clisson distrusted him instantly. The Zulans were godless, worshipping only their own bodies. Their shameless, overt sexuality and raw narcissism disgusted him. They'd rejected their deities for a doctrine of self-love and a cultish belief that they could perfect themselves without the need for higher powers. In practice, of course, it was only the nobility who had enough idle time to explore their own orifices with such mystical fervour. The lower castes starved and slaved, as they did in all lesser societies. The Zulans thought themselves sophisticates, but the way they neglected their own poor was barbarous. "Those who do not stand united will fall apart." That was a Croden saying. The Ossians, predictably, had nothing similar in their language, and Clisson suspected the Zulans didn't either. "This is a strange place to find a Zulan," he observed, "deep in the heart of Ossia, far from anywhere." Rappapet spread his hands. Elegant lace ruffs surrounded narrow wrists. "Fate is strange, Overwatchman. I came here as a young man seeking adventure and fell in love with the woman who owned this inn. We had 12 happy years together before Sarla took her. Now I own it."
"Sarla?" Clisson raised an eyebrow. Rappapet smiled. "Forgive me. My wife's gods became mine and I keep them to honour her. Of course, I would also attend convocation to praise the Primus if I could, but the nearest temple is far from here."
"I bet you would," thought Clisson. He adjusted his spectacles.
"I'll be blunt. My interest is in a man with a large scar across his throat. Do you know him?"
A hesitation, deciding whether to lie. It was answer enough for Clisson, but he waited for a reply nonetheless.
"I know him a little," said Rappapet. "He was here a few days ago. He calls himself Garrick now, though he used a different name before that."
"Right answer," thought Clisson.
"And you spoke to him?"
Another flicker of uncertainty, calculating what he could safely say.
"It's a simple question," Clisson said, sharp and quick, before he could formulate a response.
"Stop thinking. Tell me the truth."
"Forgive me," said Rappapet, getting a little flustered now. "Yes, I did. We spoke in the common room the night before the road patrol came."
"What did you speak of?"
"He needed transportation for his companions. The 2 boys and the Skarl. Any city or town would do, he said. I knew of some merchants who would take them to Greenrock, and he seemed happy with that."
Interesting. But they did not leave. No, I don't know why.
Clisson believed that. Zulans were hard to read, especially the highborn ones. Their faces revealed only what they wanted them to. But his instincts told him that this, at least, was true.
And Garrick? He asked. Surely he needed transport, too.
He sought passage to Morgonholm.
The slightest change of tone in his voice, the uncertain way he ended the sentence, told Clisson there was more to say. He held the Zulan's gaze. Specks of sweat were beginning to glisten on his shiny black scalp.
And?
Rappapet looked down at the table, discomfited.
Then we talked of other things, he admitted. He was interested in the siege engines of my homeland.
Siege engines?
This was a curious turn, and too bizarre to be false. People lied in a straight line. They thought they had to construct a narrative to be believable. But the truth usually came jumbled and from all directions at once.
Yes, he had heard of the Zataks. I think the translation is fire flinger in Krodan. I am no student of history, but I told him what I knew. It was a ballista of sorts that would throw great ceramic balls coated with pitch and set alight. The balls were hollow and held some alchemy that few understood. They destroyed their targets with great force, thunder and fire. But they often proved more dangerous to their users than their targets, and many were destroyed when the substance ignited prematurely.
He made a dainty motion in the air, some Zulan gesture Clisson didn't recognize.
That is all I can say of them.
An unusual thing to ask about.
Yes, he was very interested, and after that he changed his mind about Morgonholm. He asked if I knew anyone going north.
And did he say where he was heading?
That hesitation again. Clisson decided it was time to push.
I have travelled far to get here, Zulan, and I don't have time to waste, he said,
cool, controlled, detached. You will not wait to be asked the correct question. You will tell me everything you know and leave out nothing, or you will be arrested as a collaborator, and I will have you hanged from the sign of your own inn.
Rakan Bay, said Rappapet, almost before Clisson had finished. He was going to Rakan Bay.
Why?
Rappapet was frightened now.
I do not know. He asked me if I knew of a reliable Zulan merchant. I know of only one, my cousin, Atatep. He's a sailor who trades along the coast and often visits Rakan Bay to restock. But Atatep is a lawful man, I swear. I did not know that this Garrick was wanted by the Iron Hand.
You did not want to involve your cousin. Now I see why you were reluctant to talk.
If what you say is true, he will not be harmed. It is Garrick I'm after. Did he say what he wanted from your cousin?
I asked Overwatchman, but he would not say.
Rappapet was desperate for Clisson to believe him. Clisson gazed into his eyes until he was sure that he did.
You may go, he said.
Rappapet sagged like a fish taken down from a hook. He hurried clumsily from the booth, all grace lost in his haste. Hart sniffed.
I still say you could have started with him and saved us an afternoon.
Clisson ignored him.
Captain Dressel,
he called, getting to his feet. Dressel walked over and saluted smartly.
Gather your men and send to the Dreadnights. We leave for Rakan Bay immediately.
What about my lunch?
Hart cried indignantly.
You can eat on the road, said Clisson, sweeping past him.
He treasured the sound of Hart's outraged curses all the way back to the carriage.
52. The morning was chill and damp, and the wind carried the threat of winter. Kiel stood at the crest of a gentle rise, with the wide water of the cut at his back, and bracken rustling all around him. At the end of the trail was a small cottage of stone and thatch, with a thriving vegetable patch to one side. Smoke unwound slowly from the chimney. He'd been standing there for some time now, watching the cottage. caught between the desire to run to the door and the desire to turn around and leave unobserved. A tight band squeezed his chest, and he felt light-headed with nerves born of equal parts excitement and dread. "What are you afraid of? It's your family." But he was afraid. Afraid that things had changed. Afraid of the reckoning he faced each time he returned. Afraid this cottage would become his hutch. He took a bag of coins from his pouch, weighed it in his hand. Croden money from the Salt Fork coffers. It was more than he usually came back with, but it never felt adequate. Half of what he took had been spent on the way. Money always had a way of slipping through his fingers. Perhaps he just didn't care about it enough. It was deeds, not coin, that brought him to life. But his tales of adventure would get no welcome here. It was coin that counted, and in that he was always destined to disappoint her. "Keel, you're a fool," he said aloud, to shame himself into action. "All this way, and you think of turning back? Stop wasting time out here when your wife waits inside." Heartened, he replaced the bag of coins and set off down the trail, putting a swing in his stride. Yes, they'd fight, didn't they always? But there'd be love, too, as there always was. And how he'd missed her eyes, her smile, the soft, warm touch of her body. Roamer though he was, he'd lain with no other since they were married, and his step quickened at the thought of what the night might bring. He thought of Tad, too. Strange, quiet Tad, distant and beautiful. The fey changeling they'd brought into the world together. He didn't smile often, but when he did it was like the sun breaking over the sea. Keel ached to see that smile again. His son was a puzzle he'd never solve, but those occasional moments of connection, those small victories when his face cleared and there was laughter in his eyes, made all the struggle worthwhile. Joy welled up within him, and his doubts dissolved as he reached the door and threw it open.
"Wife! To me!" he roared. "I'm back!"
Two startled faces turned towards him. Their owners were halfway through a breakfast of fish broth and bread, sitting at a small table that stood against the wall of the stone-floored kitchen. One was Mariella, fairer to his eyes in real life than in his most rose-tinted memories. The other was his brother, Fluke.
"What's this?"
he said, his face falling a little.
"Keel!"
Mariella cried, knocking back her stool as she surged to her feet. She flung her arms round his neck and kissed him, hard and hungrily. He forgot everything in the white heat of her. It was all so right. The smell of her skin and hair, the way she fitted in his arms, the way she wanted him. Past and future faded away, and there was only sensation and nothing else. The sound of a stool scraping along the floor jerked him from bliss. He opened his eyes, and there was Fluke, dark and sour, wearing that half-scowl of disapproval Keel knew so well. His younger brother was stockier than he, broader of face. Once he'd styled himself whaler fashion, as Keel did, with a strip of long hair down the centre of his skull and shaved elsewhere. But he'd been a landsman for many years now, and his black curly hair had grown out thick all over.
"Brother," he said in greeting.
Keel let go of his wife and embraced him without enthusiasm because form demanded it.
"It's good you're back," said Fluke. "It's good to be back," said Keel.
Neither of them sounded quite sure if they meant it. Fluke grunted, as if the business of his brother's sudden appearance had now been concluded, and there was nothing more to be said on it.
"I'll let you catch up, then," he told them. "Reckon I'll head back to the farm."
He patted Keel on the shoulder, as if in consolation.
"Come see me after, eh?"
"I'll do that," said Keel.
Fluke gave Mariella a meaningful look, which Keel didn't much like, and sloped off. Keel rounded on his wife.
"Well, this is some homecoming."
He
He didn't want to get angry, but it was happening anyway. Fluke's presence had spoiled his grand entrance, and he felt foolish.
"Don't," said Mariella. "He comes over for breakfast after he's fed the animals, and I like the company in the morning. Makes the place feel a little less empty."
He heard the resentment in that. Things were already sharpening between them. He knew where that would lead, and it wasn't anywhere he was keen to go. With some effort, he reined himself in and tried to dismiss the spectre of his younger brother.
"Forgive me," he said, laying his hand on her arm. "It was just a surprise."
"Did you expect me to be here on my own, staring at the door like a good wife, waiting for the day you choose to return?"
She didn't respond to his touch. The passion of a few moments ago had gone. She'd remembered her grievances.
"Of course not. Forget all that. I'm back."
Still, she didn't melt.
"And how long are you back for?"
He felt his heart sink a little. She had to ask that, didn't she?
"I don't know," he said, removing his hand.
She said nothing in reply. There was frost in the set of her shoulders. Joe, he'd only just walked in after months away. Couldn't they go back to the kissing? Couldn't she be happy to see him now, without complicating it with talk of the future? He stepped away, feeling unwanted, out of place in his own house. Things had been moved and changed in his absence. Mariella had a new tablecloth. There was a new pot on the sill. Someone had repaired that broken chair, Fluke, no doubt. The thought irked him. Likely his brother's coin had paid for the tablecloth and pot, too. Every time he returned, this seemed less like home. He dug into his pouch and dropped the bag of coins on the table. There. Let her see that he could provide, too. Mariella looked down at it. No gratitude there, of course. He shouldn't have expected any.
"It's not much, but it'll see you through the winter," he said, his voice tight as he fought the unmanly urge to sulk.
She raised her eyes to his, and there was a bleak sadness there that sent tendrils of dread wrapping round his heart. He thought of Fluke's meaningful look as he left, and suddenly he knew its cause.
"Where's Tad?" he asked.
Tad's room was dim with the curtains drawn. A floorboard creaked beneath Keel's boot as he came in, and he cursed softly. He always forgot about that floorboard. He remembered the smell of this room more than the sight of it, the clean, healthy scent of boyhood. But the air was musty now and reeked of convalescence. In the bed, tucked up to his neck in blankets, was Tad, or at least a sallow approximation of him. His eyes were closed, the sockets dark, and his breath bubbled as he pulled it in and out. The sight of him was a shock. It was hard to see him so changed. Keel looked away, needing a moment to gather himself. Mariella had come in behind him. She slipped her hand into his.
"It's his lungs," she said. "He's got the grip."
The grip. Keel had known from the moment he stepped into the room, but the confirmation sent a wave of weakness through him nonetheless.
"How?"
was the first thing he could think of to say. "Off the boats? Some merchant from the Rainlands? What does it matter?" She sounded washed out, resigned. He wasn't used to that tone from her.
"He's had it since Aspect's day or thereabouts."
"He's been like this since late spring?" Keel hissed, appalled.
The accusation in his voice awoke her temper.
"What should I have done?" she hissed back, snatching her hand away. "Should I have had old Ganny write you a letter? And what would he use as an address?"
Keel bit back a reply.
"You could have tried, you could have found me."
But she couldn't. He wasn't anywhere to be found. He was furious at himself, not her. He stared at his boy, listening to the moist wheeze that came with every breath, the tide of his life, in and out. It didn't feel real.
"What does Padre say?" he asked.
little of worth, she replied. He knew what she thought of the town herbalist. Everyone thought the same. He prescribed some weeds which did nothing. I went to another herbalist and another after that, and each gave me something different and all of it was useless. In the end, Fluke sent for the Croden doctor from Harles Beach. Keel felt something curdle in his gut at that. It was his job to provide for his family. Who gave Fluke the right to bring in the squareheads? Wasn't the Ossian way good enough? Once again he stopped himself before he could say something he'd regret. Seemed like he was always doing that round Mariella. Just being near her turned him into a stroppy boy. If he was honest with himself, in Fluke's shoes he'd have done the same. Difference was, he wouldn't have had the money. His family couldn't live on what he brought back, and if it weren't for Fluke's charity, they'd starve. The only way he'd have been able to afford a Croden doctor was by begging his younger brother for help. Every moment he spent in Rackon Bay, he was reminded of that. "Don't you want to know what he said?" Mariella said when he didn't ask. "Yes," he said. "No, I don't want to hear it." "He said we need to take him somewhere the air is drier, away from the coast. He needs the care of a proper doctor, a Croden doctor, not some quack who'll serve him root stew and call it medicine. And he needs some kind of device. It's like a helmet that he puts on, like a mask. There's a contraption that makes vapours from herbs and he breathes them." She tailed off. "I don't understand it all. Fluke can explain it better than I." Keel's heart sank further. He didn't need to hear Fluke explain it. They'd never have that kind of money, and moving away would be nigh on impossible. Even buying the permits was beyond their means. Just one visit from the doctor would have cost Fluke more than he could spare. Regular care was out of the question for all but the richest Ossians. Crodens had access to doctors for free, paid for by the Empire, but that courtesy didn't extend to their subjects. A drier climate. Doctors. A vapour mask. Might as well try to pull the moons down from the sky. "What happens if we can't?" he asked grimly.
"You know what happens," she whispered,
and her eyes glittered with tears.
"Within a year, the doctor said. If he was strong, he'd last longer. But he's never been strong."
Tad's breathing changed then, and he snorted and stirred.
"I'll get him some broth," said Mariella.
Keel almost reached out to stop her, but she was gone too suddenly. What would he say, anyway?
"Don't leave me alone in here." How could he?
She'd never understood that part of him, the way he feared himself and dreaded solitude. He needed the company of others to stop his thoughts turning inwards, devouring themselves and him with them. As a young man, he'd stared into that abyss more than once, that terrible place where joy and ambition became pointless, and he was surrounded by the cold profundity of death. Time and toil brought him out of it, but the experience had left its mark, and he never wanted to go back. Better to distract himself. Better not to dwell on things. He'd found that distraction in the camaraderie of sailors, in Mariella's love, in a friendship with Garrick that was more like brotherhood. And given the choice between following Garrick or staying in Rackon Bay with his family, it was the lure of the road that decided it. Routine led back to the darkness. He needed to make the world new every day. He stood awkwardly by the door, watching Tad struggle up from sleep as the void billowed in his mind. He tried to push it back, but he didn't know how, and
eyes, tendrils, mouths with teeth like hooks, and the smell of it was like...
He crushed his eyes shut, mashed them with the heels of his hands as if he could press out the memory of the beast of Skavengard. The others had glimpsed it in silhouette, protected from its horror by blinding light, but he'd looked into its ungodly eye and seen the foul intelligence there. He'd been scorched by the force of its mind. He hadn't slept since without seeing it, and it ambushed him during his waking hours as well. Skavengard had marked them all, but none so deeply as he.
He'd glimpsed the nature of the things that lurked beyond the Shadowlands, the vast and hungry entities that stirred in their prison beneath Kaer Vishnach, the Citadel of Chains. How could anything be the same after that?
Da?
He took his hands away from his face. Tad's eyes were open, his head turned to one side on the pillow. His gaze was clear and steady, and he had that half-puzzled, half-curious expression on his face. The sight of his son shredded the darkness in his mind. He was a father. He wouldn't greet his son with weakness.
"My boy," he said,
and a smile came easily to his face. He opened his arms wide.
"I'm back."
There was no smile from Tad, no happiness at his father's return. Keel's arms wilted under that calm regard. His enthusiastic greeting felt forced and theatrical now. Keel had always wanted a son he could knock about with, one who'd be pleased with the rough, bluff parenting he'd learned from his own da. But Tad hated romping, and found manly humour bewildering. Not for the first time, Keel wondered how he and Mariella had managed to create a child that was nothing like either of them. He sat down on a stool next to the bed and pushed Tad's hair back from his forehead.
"Your ma tells me you're not feeling well," he said.
"Sorry, da."
"Nothing to be sorry about. Even the strongest man can be felled by illness. Everick the Red spent half his youth abed, but he went on to unify Ossia after the fall, conquered the barbarian warlords and began the Age of Kings. He was the first to wield the Ember Blade in 400 years, after everyone thought it was lost. The Dawn Wardens had been keeping it secretly all that time, waiting for someone like him. How about that? Not bad for a feeble boy."
Tad just looked up at him. Keel stroked his head gently and felt himself pierced by a cold shard of grief. His helplessness frightened him. He didn't know what to say or do. How was it possible to love somebody so and yet be strangers?
"Have you had adventures?" Tad asked.
"I have. All over the country. We faced many perils, me and your Uncle Lane. High seas, Croden soldiers."
"Monsters," he thought, and it flashed through his mind again, black tentacles squirming down the corridors, a dozen mouths gnashing behind him.
"Ma says you're fighting to save Ossia. That's why you're always away."
Something twisted in his chest at that. Yes, that was the story he told. Sometimes he even believed it himself. He heard Mariella on the stairs.
"Here's your ma now," he said, relieved.
She came in with a bowl of fish broth and a brave smile for them both. Tad struggled to sit up against the headboard, so Keel helped him. Even that small movement appeared to exhaust him, and he slumped there limply, wheezing.
"Can I?" he asked Mariella, holding out his hand for the broth.
"He can feed himself," Mariella said. "Just give him a moment to rest."
"I want to," said Keel, quietly insistent.
Mariella handed over the bowl. He filled a spoon, blew on it, held it up for his son.
"Some of your ma's broth," he said. "Make you strong again, eh?"
Tad opened his mouth and accepted it like a baby. Keel filled the spoon again. He felt Mariella's eyes on him, but he wouldn't look up at her. He was afraid she'd see the pain in him, the feeling in his chest as if he was splitting open from the inside.
"I'm here now," he murmured, as he fed another spoonful of broth to his son. "I'm back."
Later, when Tad was asleep again, they made love in a hot tangle of blankets and limbs. The first time it was desperate, savage, driven by their need to be together after so long apart. The second time they were gentler, lingering as they rediscovered each other's bodies, finding old flaws and new scars. Afterwards they lay together, her head on his chest, while his gaze roamed the ceiling, tracing familiar walls and cracks in the beams. They, at least, were the same as they'd ever been.
With Mariella in the circle of his arm, and the sweat cooling on their skin, he didn't need to think further than the walls of their bedroom, and everything was perfect. It didn't last, of course. Soon she began to talk, to tell him of what had passed in Rackham Bay while he'd been away. Grievances between neighbours, Abner's boy running wild, bad fishing due to summer storms. Little Espy had got herself with child and wouldn't say who the father was. Keel listened and nodded and tried to ignore the feeling that his soul was shriveling with every new tale. The same names he'd known all his life, the same petty gossip, none of it worth a whale's fart to anyone outside their little town. While he'd been trying to start a revolution, she'd struck a deal with a fisherman to shave a few bits off the price of her weekly shop. He wanted to care, because she cared, but the best he could do was pretend. Even together they were so far apart, and the distance was only increasing. "Jadrell's worse than ever," she was saying. "He styles himself a lord, as if that has meaning any more, and he treats us like we're serfs of old. Everyone knows how he keeps his title. His father did well out of the invasion, but Jadrell's done better still. Seems like every month another building or farm falls into his hands. He owns half the town now." "Collaborator," Keel muttered angrily. Lord Jadrell was news he could care about. He'd love to put a sword through that treacherous snake. He and his father had been brazen in their support for the new regime, and plenty of Ossians in Rackham Bay had gone to the camps and gallows because Jadrell had whispered in a Croden ear. The only crime most of them was guilty of was owning something Jadrell wanted.
"He's got his eye on this place too," Mariella warned, "and your brother's farm."
Keel saw through that one. Jadrell didn't care about some insignificant cottage or one barely prosperous farm. He felt the last of his inner peace fade away as he prepared for the inevitable argument to come.
"Where's Lane, anyway?" she asked, circling towards her point. "Or Garrick, now, is it? Why'd he change his name?"
"Because Lane's a dangerous name to bear these days. He's down in the town, seeing to business."
"Secure in your escape, no doubt," she muttered. He sighed. "Must we do this again?"
Mariella was determined they must.
"Haven't you done enough for him?" she asked. "Aren't you tired of following him about? Let him fight this crusade on his own."
"I don't do it for him. I do it because it needs doing. So people like Lord Jadrell can't take our house from us just because he knows which Croden arse to kiss."
"That's not why you do it," she said, and rolled off him.
He turned onto his side too, facing the other way, and pillowed his head with his arm. It was a grey day outside, and the bracken was stirring on the hill.
"You need to stay," she said quietly.
"We need money," he said. "A lot of it. I can't make that kind of money in Rackham Bay."
"No."
She rolled back again with a rustle of blankets and sat up, her fingers clutching his shoulder.
"No, don't go again. Tad needs you.
Fluke will give you a job on the farm. He's said he will all along."
"Ha! And suffer his judgment every day of my life. I'm God's damned if I'll be employed by my little brother. If I stayed, I'd go back to the boats."
"And then you'd only be away a month at a time instead of whole seasons. Quite an improvement that'll be," she said sarcastically. "I want you here, Keel. I want to wake up with you. I want you to be there for our son."
"I have to do something," he cried, flinging off the covers and sitting up. "I won't stand by and watch him die."
"No, you'll turn your back so you don't have to."
The defeat in her voice was the worst of it. He wanted her to scream and shout, to pound him with her fists, not to give up like that. He couldn't go on if she gave up on him.
"We have a druidess with us," he said. "Maybe she can do better than Podry."
She was hardly listening. She knew the Croden cure was beyond them, and in her heart she'd accepted that Tad would die. She wouldn't dare admit hope.
"I love you, Keel," she said. "I wish to Johar I didn't. Every day I wake up alone. All this time, at least I had Tad. But now..."
She couldn't finish.
"Stay with me."
He kissed her because he knew she needed it and because it was better than an answer. His hand found her breast, and he pushed her back onto the bed. She was just as eager as he to forget the world. For a time they almost managed it. If only there weren't any words, he thought. If only they could just be together. If only. 53. The docks were busy beneath the steel-grey roof of the morning. Merchant vessels rocked at anchor, while burly stevedores of many nations loaded them with produce. Croden customs men roamed about, nosing into this and that, quills waggling as they scribbled down their observations. Fishing boats crept back with the morning's catch, while gulls wheeled and called overhead, and the air smelled of salt and wet wood. Garrick leaned against a warped fence, shucking an oyster with his knife. He cracked open the shell with a twist, ran the blade expertly round the inside, and tipped the oyster into his mouth. Fresh Rackan Bay oysters. Nothing tasted quite like them. If there was any place he might have called home these last 30 years, this was it. He'd never loved the town, but there was comfort in familiarity, and it eased his heart to be back. A light fog lay on the water. The north bank of the cut was lost to sight, but the crooked silhouette of the ghoul fort was still visible in the murk. Half ruined, it brooded out in the channel on a lonely island of rock, a hulking pile of spikes and angles patrolled by crows. Folk called it the ghoul fort because in high winds it howled like the undead still walked there, and they steered well clear of it. But Garrick knew it by another name, Anak Nazul, it was called in the harsh tongue of the Erds. It had been built in the days of the First Empire, when men were slaves and the Erds ruled Embria from coast to coast. Their strongholds had mostly been destroyed during the reclamation, torn down for materials, taking the bad memories of former masters with them. But it had been the wish of Jessa Wolfsheart, left to posterity by her lover Morgan, that some strongholds should remain abandoned. They were to be a warning from history, a plea to never relax their vigilance lest evil creep back in. Would that we had taken more heed, Garrick thought. Instead, they'd become soft and divided, squabbling among themselves while their neighbours in Croda were reforged by the word and the sword. They'd become appeasers, denying the threat from the east till it was too late. When Croda invaded Brunland and Ozak 70 years ago, reclaiming their old territories, Ossia didn't react. When the Crodans took Estria and the Glass University 35 years later, Ossia should have been making ready for war, but the nobility were too busy with their own small struggles. All that warning, and it was still a surprise when Croda attacked. Ossia crumbled, Queen Alessandra Eventongue was executed, and the Ember Blade was seized by a crafty young Croden general called Dakan, which effectively ended the resistance. But what would have happened if it hadn't been seized? The question had obsessed Garrick for 30 years now. He'd turned it over and over, and never found an answer he could believe with any certainty. If the Crodans hadn't taken the Ember Blade so early in the invasion, the Ossians could have rallied. Queen or no queen, the Ember Blade might have been enough to unite the nobility. Wars had been won from worse positions. Or perhaps he was deluding himself, and it would only have extended the slaughter. The Crodans were tactically superior, better armed, more disciplined, and most importantly, they fought together for a common goal. To battle on would have cost tens of thousands more lives, and when the surrender came, they'd have been crushed into near slavery for their efforts, just like the brave men and women of Brunland who refused to give up and paid the price.
Aaron's father had believed it was better to submit, to exchange a hopeless war for a merciful peace. Garrick's opinion was different. He pulled another oyster from the string bag, stuck in the knife, twisted till its shell cracked. "Damned be all the peacemakers," he thought. "Cowards by another name."
"Lane of Heath Edge," said a voice at his shoulder, "as I live and breathe."
"Surprised to see you living and breathing at all, Ambry," said Garrick with half a smile.
Ambry cackled. He was a scrawny man, muscles slack with age, his sagging face haggard with white stubble. Almost 70 years lay on his bones, and a life at sea had rubbed him ragged. He walked with a crutch under one arm, and his trousers were tied below the stump of his right leg, where a crude peg took the place of his foot.
"Whale get you at last?" Garrick asked.
"Ha! Hey-ho, hey-ho, stay abed, Boric," he sang, and gave Garrick a rotted grin. "They won't write a song about me, though. Rusty nail did for me foot. Started going black, so off it came."
"You always swore you'd die at sea."
"Life has its turns, don't it? Nine, the peg rubs something awful, though. What I'd give for one of them nice Maillard limbs."
He leaned up next to Garrick and laid his crutch against the barrier, looking out across the dock.
"Back for long?" he asked.
"Just passing through."
"Ah, probably wise. The hunt's not what it was. Carthanians catch most of them these days, the bloody thieves. All the old hands are dying off or turning to drink when they're too feeble to sail. Their sons run the boats now, and being young they got to do everything their own way, which, needless to say, ain't so good as ours."
Garrick snorted his agreement and offered Ambry an oyster. Ambry thanked him, and he shucked another for himself. The old man was easy company, a friend from his whaling days, though they'd never been close. They listened to the gulls with the salty, meaty taste of Rackham Bay oysters on their tongues.
"There's our lord and master," said Ambry, tilting his chin out towards the water.
A boat was coming down the coast, painted in the colours of Jadral's house. It was his personal launch, which he used to visit other towns on the far bank of the cut. An open boat with raised and covered decks at both ends, big enough for the lord of Rackham Bay and a few guests to travel in comfort with a skeleton crew. Oars sculled the water to either side, for the winds and tides in the channel were too unreliable for a small craft to travel by sail alone.
"I see he still prospers," Garrick said scathingly.
"He does. Primus be thanked for his wise stewardship in these troubled times."
Ambry's tone was so dry his words could have been used for kindling.
"Most times we don't even see him, except at a distance. Spends all his time with the squareheads."
"You should be more careful," said Garrick, wryly. "I could be an informer."
"You could be," Ambry agreed. "Give my regards to our geometrically perfect overlords when you see 'em."
Garrick barked with laughter. It had the sound of a quip heard elsewhere and oft repeated. Ambry didn't have the vocabulary to come up with that himself, but it was a good one nonetheless. They shared the rest of the oysters while they watched Jadral's boat approach. As Ambry had said, it didn't come into the harbour, but docked further up the coast, pulling into a private jetty at the foot of a steep slope. Three men disembarked, all wearing stiff jackets, straight trousers and boots. Croden dress. One of them was likely Jadral, but at this distance he was indistinguishable from his guests.
"Our lord's more Croden than the Crodens these days," said Ambry,
catching his thought.
"Funny thing is, the young squareheads get more Ossian every year, to annoy their folks, I reckon."
He chuckled.
"Kids are kids wherever they're from."
Jadral and his companions climbed a set of stairs up the slope towards the base of a cliff, topped by an imposing mansion which overlooked the water. The crew busied themselves with attaching thick ropes and hooks to the boat's hull, and manoeuvring it round to a wooden slipway running down the length of the slope.
"Are they going to winch that thing in?"
Garrick asked, in surprise.
"Never were much of a sailor, were you? Storms come on quick this time of year. That jetty's no shelter, and a boat like that's too fine to smash up. There's a boathouse at the top of the slope, see?"
Garrick saw it now, a large shed below the mansion. The crew shouted up to the boathouse, and Jadrell's craft was slowly pulled from the water, sliding up the slipway until it disappeared inside.
"Easier to put in at the harbour, surely,"
Garrick said. There was a breakwater out there, a kinked bank of piled stones reaching out into the cut, which protected the boats moored at the docks.
"Lords and fishermen side by side. That's the tradition, since anyone can remember. Ain't like that now, though. Been long a day since Lord Jadrell put in at the harbour. Too good for us."
"Times change," said Garrick.
"They do," said Ambry, "and they'll change again."
He offered Garrick a plug of tobacco, and when Garrick refused, he popped one in his mouth and chewed.
"Young'uns now, they don't know what freedom is. But we remember, don't we? All them nobles who bent over for the Crodens, they're on top now. But they'll get theirs when the Dawn Wardens come back."
Garrick gave him a look of vague incredulity.
"The Dawn Wardens are gone," he said. "They've been gone 200 years or more, since they collaborated in the overthrow of King Danna the Moon-Touched."
"Pfft, you believe that?"
"He wielded the Ember Blade and they betrayed him. For good reason. He was a half-wit enthralled to his cousin in Harrow. He'd have signed over everything north of the Cut to those stuck-up bastards, and the rest of Ossia would have gone after. We'd be bowing to the Harish now instead of Crodens, only we'd have had 2 centuries more to get used to it."
"That's true," Garrick agreed bitterly. "And if not the Crodens, it'd be the Ellaroo or the Durnish or someone else.
Some days I think we were born to be slaves."
"Ha! You sound like you used to in the bellied sail. Always were a maudlin drunk,"
Ambry complained.
"A Dawn Warden's loyalty was to the Ember Blade, not the one who wielded it. To Ossia, not its rulers. They done right by their oath, and by the land."
"The king they put on the throne didn't see it that way."
"He loved the Dawn Wardens well enough till his own right to rule got called into question.
Reckon he was afraid they might play kingmaker again, so he got rid of them. They've guarded this land since the first days of the Second Empire, since Rannis the Librarian put them together. Think a coward like Garam Hawkeye could tear them apart."
He waved a gnarled hand and spat brown juice over the barrier.
"They disappeared for centuries after the Empire fell, but they came back when we needed them, and brung the Ember Blade with them. That's what they do. Mark me, they're out there somewhere, waiting for their chance. And now the Ember Blade returns to Ossia. If that ain't a sign, I don't know what is."
Garrick felt his mood blackening, and the oysters turned sour in his mouth.
"Maybe that's our problem," he said. "Too long we've waited for heroes to come and save us instead of saving ourselves."
Ambry took up his crutch and straightened. He pointed across the cut to where the ghoul fort lurked in jagged silhouette.
"There were a sight more of us than the Erds. We could have risen up against them any time, but we didn't. We was slaves 'cause they took away our hope. Took a plague to show us they could be toppled, and even then we needed Jessa Wolf's art to get us off our knees."
He chewed on his tobacco plug with a wet, smacking sound.
"Folk won't fight lest they believe they can win. She made us believe. And the Dawn Wardens'll make us believe, too."
He eyed Garrick closely.
"Think I don't know what you and Keel have been up to. I heard you talk when you was in your cups. I know why you left. You with the Grey Cloaks now?"
"There's no such thing as the Grey Cloaks," Garrick said.
"That's what I'd say if I was in the Grey Cloaks,"
Ambry cackled.
"This land ain't done yet. The blood of the wolf still runs in Ossian veins, same blood that built the Second Empire. You can't cage a wolf."
You can, said Garrick. We call them dogs.
Ambry snorted.
Between waiting for a hero and listening to a cynic, I know which I'd choose. Today's empires are tomorrow's ashes. No one knows that like we Ossians.
I never reckoned you an optimist.
Getting your foot sawn off gives you some perspective, I reckon.
Garrick smiled grimly at that and patted him on the shoulder.
It was good to see you again, Ambry.
Likewise.
Garrick walked off along the dock. When he looked back, the old man was staring across the foggy water, his eyes far away as he gazed into white emptiness. 54.
There.
Aaron scanned the woods. Bracken and thorn grew thick between the trees, and leaves rustled in a cool wind that smelled of salt and rain. Fenn pointed. In the distance, grazing between the trees, was a doe. She flashed him a hunter's sign he didn't recognize, but he got the gist. They began to sneak closer to the doe, Fenn leading, Aaron close behind. A loud snap sounded beneath his boot, and they froze as the doe tensed and lifted its head. Its hindquarters trembled as it hovered on the edge of bolting, but they were some distance away and it didn't see them. Warily, it returned to grazing. Fenn looked over her shoulder with a scowl. Her voice was a harsh whisper.
Feet! What did I tell you?
He made an apologetic face. It's my first time, he offered as an excuse. She sucked her forefinger and held it in the air.
The wind's still with us. Can you feel the direction it's coming from?
Aaron copied her. If he was honest, all it did was make his finger cold. He decided not to be honest.
I feel it,
he said, with a dawning amazement on his face that was entirely fake. It seemed to please her, anyway, for she softened.
Always come at them from downwind. If they smell you, they'll run. Hunting is all about patience.
They crept closer to the doe. Aaron tried to concentrate on his feet, but he found himself sneaking glances at Fenn instead. At first, he worried she'd notice him, but her eyes were fixed on her quarry, and soon he was studying her openly. He wanted to be able to see her, to understand her the way he'd done with Rafa back at Sulla's Bluff. But she was closed to him, a puzzle still. She'd offered no thanks for his help in Skavengard, nor any apology for being cold and rude afterwards. In fact, she'd been angry with him for the last few days. And yet this morning she asked him if he knew how to hunt, and when he said no, she offered to teach him. He knew Cade would sulk when he found out. He told himself he was doing it because hunting was a useful skill to have when you were out in the world on your own. But in truth, his decision had nothing to do with that. It wasn't even that he thought her pretty, it was just that her features were so fascinating. Her freckles were so densely packed, they'd merged into a kind of mask. He'd never seen anyone with so many freckles. The delicate curve of her jawbone held an inexplicable interest for him, as did the way her nose wrinkled when she laughed, when she really laughed. It wasn't often she laughed like that, but Cade had the knack of making her, and Aaron was surprised to find he was a little jealous about that. He took a certain childish pride in the fact she'd asked him to hunt with her, and not Cade.
Where's the harm, anyway?
Cade wanted us to stay, didn't he? He's not the only one who can make friends. Distracted, his foot caught a stone, and he stumbled against a bush with a loud rustle. Fenn grabbed his arm and yanked him down into the bracken as the startled doe's head shot up again. They crouched there, pressed close. Aaron became uncomfortably, thrillingly aware of the contact between them. As the doe stood trembling, ears twitching, deciding whether or not to flee, Aaron knew how it felt. Neither Fenn nor Aaron moved a muscle until the doe trotted a short way off and began to graze again. When she at last shifted away from him, he was both relieved and disappointed.
"Reckon I'll get no closer with you in tow, Bumblefoot," said Fen.
She slipped her bow from her back.
"We'll kill it from here. You know how to shoot?"
"A little. Most of my lessons were in the sword."
"Want to try?"
she said, holding it out to him. He gave her a rueful smile.
"That's got to be 60 yards through the trees. I'm not that good. We'd lose the kill and waste an arrow."
The look she gave him was uncertain, as if she thought she'd done something wrong by offering. Then she shrugged to show she didn't care, and slipped off through the bracken to the cover of a nearby tree. She stood slowly, knocked, drew, and aimed. The doe raised its head, perhaps warned by some instinct.
"Shoot," Aaron urged her silently, "before it runs."
But she didn't. She waited, the muscles in her arms beginning to tremble, till the doe relaxed and lowered its head once more. Only then did she let fly. The arrow whisked through the leaves. The doe shied and bolted. Fen bolted with it. Aaron, surprised, was slow to follow. He hadn't expected her to run. Had she hit it? He wasn't sure. It had all been too quick to see. By the time he was on his feet, she was almost out of sight, chasing her target through the undergrowth. He blundered after her, but she was nimble and he couldn't keep up. He tripped over a stone and fell, and when he picked himself up, she was gone. Cursing his clumsiness, he forged onwards, following the sound of breaking branches, until at last he stumbled across them again. The doe had fallen at the edge of a clearing, and was lying limp on its side, its fur stained with blood, and Fen's arrow buried in its flank. She was kneeling next to it, one hand on its ribs next to the wound. Her head was bowed, her eyes closed, and her mouth moving in prayer. Aaron approached as quietly as he could, loath to disturb her. There was something intimate about the scene, a connection between hunter and hunted, the living and the dying. As he came closer, he heard some of what Fen was saying. She was offering thanks to the doe for the gift of its life, and to Og Aspect of Beasts for a successful hunt. When she was done, she raised her head and began to stroke the doe's neck, murmuring softly.
"There you. It'll be over soon. Rest now. Rest."
The deer breathed its last, and its eye went glassy and blank. Fen stood to find Aaron staring at her in wonder. He'd never imagined death could be so tender. In that moment he was seized by the urge to kiss her, but he thought it would be unwelcome, and he didn't dare. If she had any idea what was in his head, she gave no sign. "We'll start you on something easier next time," she said. "Since you're here, you can carry it." Fen was irritable and tense as they made their way back to the camp. Having Aaron near put her on edge. When he spoke, she had to fight the urge to snap at him. When he didn't, she felt like she was supposed to speak. She fancied she could sense his expectant gaze boring into her back. He demanded her attention just by being there. He'd hardly said a word since she'd slain the deer, and the silence was agonizing as he trekked along in her wake, with the dead animal slung across his shoulders. She wanted to leave him to make his own way back, but he'd be lost within minutes, and the deer with him.
"Why did you invite him along?"
She had no good answer. Was it thanks for what he did in Skavengard? She'd never have gone out on that ledge if not for him, and she did feel a little bad about the way she treated him afterwards. It was just that she'd been so angry. Angry at herself for being weak, angry at him for seeing it. Angry because he'd made her climb when he didn't understand what it meant to fall, to have the world disappear from beneath your feet. And yet, as much as he annoyed her, there was something reassuring about him. He was content just to be there, and that made her feel content. He didn't ask anything of her, or pester her with questions.
It was certainly easier to be alone, but there was a strange sort of pleasure in sharing the day with another. And mostly it wasn't that hard, except that sometimes he looked at her in a way that triggered a vague sense of alarm deep inside her. She wasn't sure if she liked that feeling or not. Was this how people became friends? Nine. Why did anyone put themselves through it? So, how did your mother die? She asked, as lightly as she could manage. Aaron stopped and stared at her. Fenn felt herself curl up inside and burn like a leaf on a fire.
I'm not good at small talk, she said sullenly, as if it was his fault.
He shook off his surprise, raised a hand in apology.
That's all right, it was just a bit abrupt. She was ill. I don't know exactly what she died of. Nobody ever told me, and I suppose I never asked. Isn't that funny?
Funny, Fenn agreed, though she didn't really see why it was. What about yours? Fenn felt a wave of panic. She hadn't meant to open up the subject to include herself, but of course that was how it went, wasn't it? Get something, give something, even if you didn't want to.
She cut her hand. It went bad.
The words came out dull and terse. She didn't want to elaborate. Aaron got the hint.
I'm sorry.
Sorry for what? You didn't cut her hand.
Just, you know.
She didn't. The conversation faltered again. What was it like growing up in the Aldwood? He asked, in an attempt to spur it back to life. Fenn wasn't sure how to answer that. What remained of those days were fragments of memory. Dar's palm on her back to feel the pace of her breathing as she took aim at a stag, climbing trees near the cabin while Ma sat out front singing and whittling in the sun. The doll Ma carved for her. The scent of apple sweet griddle cakes, her parents holding hands beneath the table. Her early life was so filled with happiness and love that she found it hard to believe it wasn't some hazy dream.
Good enough, she said, till Ma died. Da was different after that.
She fought for some words that wouldn't sound false or stupid, but found none. He sensed her awkwardness and mercifully changed the subject.
Do you know what Garrick has in mind for us? He asked.
What do you mean? We're heading for Hammerholt, right? It's the most formidable fortress in Ossia, and it'll be swarming with guards for the royal wedding. How are we actually going to get the Ember Blade?
He'll tell us when we reach Morganholm.
Aaron snorted. He likes his secrets, doesn't he?
It makes sense. What if one of us were captured and interrogated? The Iron Hand would know everything then. This way's safer.
I say he's paranoid.
If you're not paranoid by now, you just haven't been paying attention. I'm sure it's in hand.
Are you?
You didn't know him before Salt Fork, she said. Back then, we'd have followed him anywhere. I have my doubts about his temperament now, but I don't doubt his heart. I'll hear him out, and if I don't like his plan, then I'll leave.
Where will you go?
She thought for a moment. Elsewhere.
Aaron nodded. She supposed he understood. His home was as lost to him as hers was, and he knew as little of the world. But he, at least, knew how to connect with people, and he had Cade. He'd do well enough. She wasn't so sure about herself.
You could have left us back at the Reaver's Rest, she said. Why didn't you?
Cade didn't want to. She gave him a skeptical look. You can do better. I didn't want to, he admitted at last. I never knew my mother. My father was everything to me. I remember how it used to feel when he'd come home after one of his trips away. The happiness, the relief at having him back. He was warm and strong and kind. He was everything I wanted to be as a man. His face twisted into a scowl. I didn't even know his name. Fenn lowered her gaze. The bitterness in his voice made her uncomfortable. I need to find out who my father was, he said at last. Only Garrick can tell me that. And the Ember Blade? Doesn't that mean anything? The Ember Blade,
His eyes went distant. Do you think Ossia really could rise again, if we took the Ember Blade back? I don't know, she said. I don't know how people think. They walked on a short way. If I knew who your father was, Aaron, I'd tell you, whatever Garrick said. Aaron was taken aback by that. Thank you, he said, and he gave her a look of such gratitude and affection that she blushed angrily and turned away. We're wasting time, she snapped. Let's get moving. She didn't say another word the whole way back to the camp. 55. The trading houses were set back from the waterfront, hidden among the cobbled lanes, far from the noise of the warehouses and the smell of fish and boiling blubber. Garrick walked down familiar streets between grey stone houses streaked with black lichen. Rackon Bay was a tangle of alleys with dwellings built higgledy-piggledy wherever they'd fit. Shop fronts appeared from nowhere. Sullen plazas lurked in ambush around blind corners. Windows were scattered without symmetry. On an overcast day like this, the town was cheerless and cold and damp, but anticipation kept Garrick warm, and he walked with purpose. If he could conclude the day's business to his satisfaction, it would be a good day indeed. He knew the Zulan trading house, though he'd never visited it before. Foreigners were common in Rackon Bay, and most nationalities had a trading house somewhere in the town. The ships that docked here were crewed by elegant Zulans, swaggering Carthanians, secretive Boscans, tattooed Skarls, and slow-talking Quins. Once in a while, a Caraguan vessel would arrive from the distant west, disgorging missionaries to spread word of the Incana, or a boatload of squabbling Lunish would turn up, unable to pass a single night without starting a fight. In the main, these visitors were met with mistrust, and few settled here. Rackon Bay liked their coin and trade, but not their strange customs. Ossians were a welcoming and tolerant people, by and large, but the Bitterbracks were peopled with harder folk, closed-mouthed, stubborn and resistant to change. The trading house was unremarkable from the outside, a building of weathered stone with small windows nestling on a corner. Only its sign was unusual. It was written in the beautiful and mysterious ideograms of the Zulan alphabet and meant nothing to an Ossian. Above it was a painting of a robed man sitting cross-legged with his arms splayed. He was lean and bald, his head dipped so that only the top was visible. Half his skull was white, the other half black. Garrick recognised him at least, the Pradap Tet, spiritual shepherd of the Zulans, whose teachings they worshipped in lieu of any god. He pushed open the door and a tiny bell rang, high and pure. Stepping inside was like stepping into another land. There was nothing of Ossian decor here, none of the exuberant colours, mismatched fabrics, old wood or scuffed stone. Instead, the room was practically bare, and everything was spotless and neatly arranged. A polished bronze ball sat on a black shelf. A framed expanse of parchment was marked with a few strokes of paint, suggesting a shape beyond Garrick's ability to interpret. A low table of rare Ellaroo whitewood, shaped like a teardrop, sat off-centre in the room, with an obsidian beaker and two glass and silver cups placed upon it. The sound of the bell faded, leaving an eerie silence behind. A young Zulan glided in from the back, his slippers whispering on the floor. He was fine-boned and shaven-headed, with a neat black beard, and he moved with the same silken poise as his countrymen from the Reaver's Rest. "Welcome," he said, in lightly accented Croden.
"Greetings to you," Garrick replied in Ossian. "I am looking for a man named Atatep. His cousin told me he often visits here."
"Alas," said the merchant, switching smoothly to Garrick's mother tongue, "Atatep departed several days ago with a cargo for my homeland. What unfortunate timing." He made an airy gesture, waving one hand limply before him. Garrick wasn't sure whether to believe that, and the Zulan's face and tone gave him no clue. It was said that in Zulan society their faces were their weapons. Every conversation was a deadly dance, and they were trained from birth to master their expressions in order to convey exactly what they wanted to.
"A shame," he said. "I'm in need of something unusual. The kind of thing only a Zulan might know how to get. I need it found and delivered fast and safely, and I was assured he was reliable."
"Perhaps I can help. Our reputation and services are second to none."
"Perhaps you can," said Garrick.
The Zulan made a florid gesture of invitation towards the table. Garrick, who knew enough of Zulan customs to expect no chair, seated himself as comfortably as he could on the floor. Habit made him reach for his sword to adjust it as he sat, but he'd left it back at the camp. Ossians were forbidden swords within town limits, and he didn't have a permit for Rakan Bay.
"My name is Katat Az," said the Zulan, seating himself gracefully. "My brother and I oversee all Zulan trade in Rakan Bay. May I have your name?"
"Danik of Hearthfall," Garrick lied. He'd lived under so many aliases these past 30 years that new names sprang quickly to his tongue.
"Honored."
Katat Az poured 2 glasses of water. He smelled of perfume, something musky, softened with a hint of jasmine.
"And this item you need?"
Garrick pushed a folded piece of paper across the table.
"My requirements," he said.
Katat Az unfolded it, glanced at it, put it down again.
4 barrels of amberline we can, of course, provide. But this is dangerous cargo."
"Can you get it for me?"
"I can. We sell it in our homeland, and sometimes to the Glass University for their experiments."
One eyebrow arched, and he pursed his lips.
"You are no chimericist, nor are you a scholar. What is your interest?"
"That's my business."
"I see. You understand that if anyone comes asking about it, I will cooperate with the authorities in all matters."
"You needn't fear. It's not contraband, and I'm no Croden informer."
Katat Az gave him a knowing smile.
"Of course you're not," he said.
Garrick didn't argue further. Mistrust of foreigners ran both ways. He took a sip of water. It was flavored with something sweet and a touch of mint.
"I need it delivered to Morganholm in 7 days, he said.
"Impossible," said Katat Az, and raised a hand to forestall Garrick's argument. "Impossible," he said again firmly. "The cargo is not in Rakan Bay, and it will require a considerable diversion to collect it. 15 days. It cannot be done faster."
The wedding was on the last day of Copperleaf. Garrick did some calculations in his head. If the cargo arrived on time, it would come 8 days before the wedding. That was time enough.
"Very well."
"It will be expensive," Katat Az warned.
Garrick tossed a bag of coins onto the table. Katat Az didn't even look at it.
"More expensive than that," he said.
"That's a deposit. I'll pay 20 falcons more on delivery to Morganholm."
Other men might have shown surprise or suspicion at such a ridiculously generous offer. Katat Az showed nothing.
"And this money is where?"
"In a bank in Morganholm," said Garrick, "though not in any account of mine."
"I am sure you have further conditions," Katat Az said, and sipped his water.
"I have 3, Garrick said. 1, it must be on time. If it's late, it's useless to me and you'll get nothing."
Katat Az dipped his head and fluttered his lashes in acceptance.
"It will not be late."
2, you'll tell nobody of this transaction, especially not your brother."
"I will keep it confidential. But as I have already said, if the authorities ask..."
"Which brings me to 3.
You will oversee the shipment personally. You'll leave on the ship tonight, and you'll be there when I meet it at Morganholm.
Katat Az studied him carefully. Garrick held his gaze.
It's that or no deal, he said.
Garrick saw that the Zulan understood. He wouldn't compromise himself by withholding any information from the Crodans, but by insisting he was on the ship, Garrick had ensured he wouldn't be around to ask.
Katat Az sighed and steepled his fingers in front of his mouth.
You realize this is a considerable inconvenience, he said. However, I do have interests in Morganholm and business I can conduct in the ports along the way. My brother can oversee things here in my absence.
He spread his hands and smiled.
Very well. I will do it. For 30 falcons.
His gaze went cold and his smile took on a sharper edge.
It's that or no deal.
It was robbery, an absurd amount of gold for the undertaking. Garrick agreed without hesitation. Negotiation was a waste of time. The only thing that mattered was that he got what he needed.
I will draw up the paperwork to ensure there is no misunderstanding about the price when I arrive, said Katat Az.
Nothing that your brother can find. Nothing in your records, Garrick warned.
I will carry it with me, the merchant assured him, and enter it into our records on my return.
Garrick grunted and scratched at the edge of his scar.
It occurs to me that you will need transport to Morganholm yourself, said Katat Az. Perhaps I can help there also.
I need passage for 9 and a dog, but we need to be there long before that shipment arrives to prepare.
There is a fast ship departing at dawn the day after tomorrow, direct to Morganholm. You will be there by Draken's Day.
Garrick nodded. Though he'd have liked to leave sooner, it would have to do. The Crodans would follow their trail to Rakan Bay eventually, after the mess they'd left at the inn, but he doubted they'd be quick enough to catch them. As far as anyone at the Reaver's Rest was concerned, Garrick and his companions were nothing more than Ossian rogues who'd killed a road patrol. Only the Dreadknights and the overwatchmen who held their leash would have any chance of running them down, and they were probably still on the other side of the mountains, yet to hear the news.
"I will book you passage," said Katat Az.
He flowed to his feet and collected the forms to be signed and stamped, along with the details of the ships. When they were done, Garrick eased himself up stiffly, and they clasped each other's forearms, Ossian style. As Garrick made to leave, the Zulan lifted a finger thoughtfully to his lips.
"Forgive me, but I must say something. When a man bargains as you do, he is either rich, desperate, or no longer cares what happens to him."
He looked Garrick up and down.
"I do not think you are rich or desperate."
Garrick gave him a level stare. 15 days, he said. Katat Az waved a slender hand.
"It shall be done."
A short walk east of the harbour was an inn called the Bellied Sail, a dour flint building perched just off the coastal path, hunkered down as if in anticipation of rain. Garrick pushed the door open and stepped into a flood of memories. This place was the closest thing to home he'd found these past 30 years. The gloom and the familiar warmth of the fires comforted him. He breathed in the smell of old smoke and ale and roast beef from the kitchen. Low, heavy beams, notched by 100 knives, had dented the heads of generations of drunkards. He walked the narrow way between the cramped wooden booths to the bar, and a feeling of welcome and warning stirred in his heart. The Bellied Sail had borne witness to some of his best times and some of his worst. As much as he loved this inn, he feared it a little too. His eyes tightened, a fractional wince of shame as he remembered his hopeless years of drunken drifting, seeking death at the bottom of a bottle or anywhere else he could find it. 8 years ago, he'd washed up here with nothing left to live for, after 2 decades of failure had brought him to despair. 2 decades of resistance against the Crodans, of plotting uprisings and fomenting discontent, of disruption and sabotage, assassination and blackmail. 2 decades of doing terrible things in the name of freedom, and all of it worth naught in the end. His allies had died or given up the fight. His countrymen's desire for revolt had diminished as they came to accept the new way of things. In the end, the disappointment had broken him. It was a stranger who put him back together. In his darkest hour, he'd confessed the shame that lay at his core, told his true name to a man he'd met over a bottle of black rum. Keel took him in, invited him onto his boat and into his crew, showed him the fury of the sea. In pain and toil, Garrick found new purpose in the red raw joy of rope-flayed hands and the icy slap of sea spray on his face. He witnessed the wild terror of nature and was made puny by the waves and the slick humped backs of breaching monsters. It took years, but as they rode the waves and slew the monsters, Garrick had become himself again. Eventually, his spirit renewed, he turned his back on the sea and set about his task once more. When he left, Keel left with him, desperate to escape Rackan Bay and a life that was strangling him. In such a way, they'd saved each other. It was early yet, and only a few patrons had taken their stations. Most of them drank alone, gazing out at the half-empty room with blearily placid expressions. Garrick used to wonder what drunks thought about all day as they nursed their mugs of ale and spoke to no one. Then he became one, and he realized they weren't thinking about anything, and that was the point. Morville, the landlord, was behind the bar, a scrawny, lanky man with a bulbous nose and a little pot belly. He was fascinatingly ugly, as if some clumsy deity had assembled him from the parts of various other men, and none of them quite matched. Right now he was half-heartedly wiping the counter with a rag, perhaps because he knew the stains wouldn't be shifted by anything short of burning the inn down. He looked up as Garrick approached. "Lane," he said, as if it had been only yesterday since he'd last seen him. Nothing was remarkable to Morville, nothing excited him. He was a man without judgment or opinion. Keel had once joked that if he ever had an emotion, it would be swiftly followed by a massive stroke. "Morville," Garrick said, equally gruff, "give me a mug of ale and a hot eel pie, and I'll need paper and something to write with." "Gonna be 3 decims for the paper and ink. 8 3/8 in all. Call it 8 even. Garrick took out a guilder, got 2 decims back, then headed to his favourite nook. After a time, Morville brought over his drink and his meal, and a quill and ink and paper. He put them down and left without a word. Garrick ate slowly, washing it down with the hoppy brown ale of the Bitterbrax. When he was done, he ordered another pint and set himself to writing. He'd learned his letters as a boy, but he was no scholar and had fallen out of practice since. It took concentration